Okay, so I know this was a multi-front attack on land, from water and air, but I need details on this. What I really want to know is, how did Hamas break through the Iron Wall, Israel's fortified border fence, on October 7? Because we're talking about a 7-meter wall with sensors, subterranean enforcements, remote control machine guns, and barbed wire in the three areas where the border runs adjacent to Israeli settlements, plus a buffer zone. So this is no regular border fence.
Short answer, a combination of technology and brute force, drones, explosives, and bulldozers. But what's more relevant to our discussion today is Mossad's intelligence collection and analysis failure preceding the Hamas attack. Get your hat in magnifying glass, Sherlock.
Hello everyone, I'm Sandra.
And I'm Tyler.
And this is Dubious.
Before we move on to today's discussion about the catastrophic failure of Israel's intelligence services, let's look real fast at the latest on this war. At the moment of this recording, the war has entered its second phase.
Yes, Israel initiated its announced land invasion into Gaza and...
It's called ground operations.
Same thing. So this will be a long war lasting months, if not longer. The humanitarian crisis there is massive, with Israel seemingly aiming to decimate the Gaza Strip with bombardments and turning Gaza into a ball of fire. Surgeons are washing wounds with soft drinks or any liquid they can find because they lack clean water, and they operate on patients using the lanterns on their mobile phones. It is estimated that more than 70% of those killed and injured in Gaza are civilians, a lot of women and children, and we're talking thousands. We don't really know the exact numbers. Not even the United Nations can keep up with the unfolding horrors. But the latest I've seen on MSNBC was over 8,000 people dead in Gaza, with almost 4,000 of them children, since this conflict started. And, you know, the numbers on the Israeli side, sadly, you know, we have the 1,400 people that were killed in that initial attack on Israel, and the hostages. And look, there have been several complete blackouts in Gaza, with telecommunication systems being shut down by Israel. So at certain points in time, victims hit by airstrikes were unable to even call the ambulances, and people would pretty much know where they were because of the fires and the screams. Anyway, because of these blackouts, the extent of the horrors can't be really relayed to the outside world and the media either. So it's absolutely horrific. And moreover, Israel has been using white phosphorus, violating international humanitarian law. Human Rights Watch verified videos, quote, taken in Lebanon and Gaza on October 10 and 11, 2023, respectively, showing multiple airbursts of artillery-fired white phosphorus over the Gaza City port and two rural locations along the Israel-Lebanon border, and interviewed people who described an attack in Gaza.
White phosphorus ignites when exposed to atmospheric oxygen and continues to burn until it is deprived of oxygen or exhausted. Its chemical reaction can create intense heat, about 815 degrees Celsius or 1500 degrees Fahrenheit, light, and smoke. Upon contact, white phosphorus can burn people, thermally and chemically, down to the bone, as it is highly soluble in fat and therefore in human flesh. White phosphorus fragments can exacerbate wounds even after treatment and can enter the bloodstream and cause multiple organ failure. Already dressed wounds can reignite, so wounds can catch fire again when dressings are removed and the wounds are re-exposed to oxygen. Even relatively minor burns are often fatal. For survivors, extensive scarring tightens muscle tissue and creates physical disabilities.
According to Human Rights Watch, the use of white phosphorus in densely populated areas of Gaza violates the requirement under international humanitarian law to take all feasible precautions to avoid civilian injury and loss of life. This concern is amplified given the technique evidenced in videos of airbursting white phosphorus projectiles. Airbursting of white phosphorus, it basically spreads over 100 burning felt wedges impregnated with the substance over an area between 125 and 250 meters in diameter, depending on the altitude of the burst, and thereby exposing more civilians to potential harm than a localized ground burst.
I don't even know what to say.
Well, no need to say anything. I mean, I think the information on its own speaks volumes. Our listeners, can draw their own conclusions. So while this is all unfolding in Gaza, Israeli families whose loved ones have been taken hostage by Hamas are desperately trying to hold on hope. They are unhappy with Netanyahu's way of handling the situation. And the families whose loved ones were murdered in Israel have been, putting them to rest, and there have been a series of funerals. It's all really harrowing. And throughout the world, people are protesting, some in support of Israel, some in support of Gaza. And I have to say, there are some protests in support of the Palestinian people, including a very big one that took place at the Central Station in New York. Some of these protests are actually organized and attended now by Jewish people who simply disagree with their government and what they're doing. At the same time, we're witnessing a rise in anti-Semitism and hate, a lot of it on university campuses of all places, and that took me by surprise, because you'd think that educated people, or people in the process of being educated, are educated and use critical thinking and behave in a decent, civilized, non-aggressive manner. But I guess not all of them. I don't want to generalize, but it struck me as very weird that an academic space would be the space where this hate would emerge. The most recent example is that Cornell student threatening Jewish colleagues with violence. It's absolutely unacceptable and horrible. And we talked about the complexities of this conflict in our latest episode, from geopolitical imperatives for the United States to why it is such a complicated situation. We won't get into any of that again, but tensions obviously seem to keep escalating even here among regular people.
Yeah, I even saw those videos of people who would rip off posters from public places, the posters for missing Israeli children taken by Hamas. And other people then filming these people asking social media users to identify them.
Oh yes, I saw there was a video with a guy who was going to the gym, and there were missing kids posters in the gym area, right? Like outside the gym, and he tore down two of them. And okay, first of all, let's be honest, the missing Israeli children are not going to be found near a gym in Venice, California, okay? They are in the tunnels under Gaza, being kept hostage by Hamas, okay? So they're not here. Secondly, by doxing whoever takes off these posters, you can potentially endanger that person's life. I mean, what's more important, a piece of paper, the missing kid poster? It's a poster, it's not the actual kid, right? So what's more important, that or an actual person, even though you might disagree with that person? But I mean, I think this just fuels, potentially more violence. And thirdly, whoever tears off these posters is just wrong. Just put up extra posters with Palestinian dead and injured children. That way people see both sides. I mean, obviously I'm trying to joke, because if we don't try to smile, we'll certainly cry. So
yeah, I understand. And on top of this, the conflict in the Middle East seems to be expanding. U.S. fighter jets launched airstrikes on October 27th on two locations in eastern Syria, linked to Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, in retaliation for a slew of drone and missile attacks against U.S. bases and personnel in the region that began early last week.
Yes, this administration is determined to maintain a delicate balance, as they should. The United States wants to hit Iranian-backed groups who targeted the U.S., possibly fueled by the Israel's war against Hamas, and we want to hit them as strongly as possible to deter future aggression, while also working to avoid inflaming the region and provoking a wider conflict. So far, my opinion, we did an excellent job in this regard, and hopefully more will be done for the civilians in Gaza too. As we said last time, it's a massively complicated geopolitical chessboard we're playing on right now.
So let's start talking about what we're supposed to be talking about. Today we're discussing the October 7th surprise attack by Hamas, which constitutes one of the biggest failures by Israeli intelligence since the Yom Kippur War of 1973. As for the specific timing of the 2023 attack, Hamas capitalized on an Israeli government that was deeply distracted, focused on judicial overhaul because of the deeply controversial reforms of Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right coalition government pushed through.
Also, the October 7 attack coincided with the 50-year anniversary of the Yom Kippur War, almost to the day. Just like in 1973, on October 7, 2023, Israel was in the middle of an important national holiday.
Well, it also coincided with Putin's 71st birthday. We talked about Putin and how this Middle East conflict favors his plans, how Russia has been supporting Hamas, and how this conflict will distract attention and potentially financial aid from Ukraine. And we'll also talk about how Hamas practiced in plain sight for this attack, posting a mock video 2 weeks prior to October 7th. In the video, they break through a replica of the Iron Wall and then move building by building through a full-scale reconstruction of an Israeli town, shooting automatic weapons.
Right, so very fast, about the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, the Yom Kippur War. It began on 6 October 1973 when the Arab coalition jointly launched a surprise attack against Israel on the Jewish holy day of Yom Kippur, which had occurred during the 10th day of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan in that year. So following the outbreak of hostilities, both the United States and the Soviet Union initiated massive resupply efforts to their allies, Israel and the Arab states respectively. The 1973 Yom Kippur War ended with an Israeli victory, but at great cost for the United States. Though the war did not scuttle detente, it nevertheless brought the United States closer to a nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union than at any point since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And in 1973, just like now, Israel's intelligence services did not see the attack coming. Matthew T. Penny from the CIA Center for the Study of Intelligence says about the Yom Kippur War, "To intelligence historians, the October 1973 war is almost synonymous with intelligence failure. On October 6th, the armies of Egypt and Syria attacked Israel, catching the Israeli and U.S. intelligence communities by surprise. A U.S. multi-agency postmortem in December that year, declassified in 2009, concluded that while the evidence of an Arab-initiated war had not been conclusive, the intelligence had been plentiful, ominous, and often accurate. The documents in this present collection attest that, for months before the war, the U.S. intelligence community had received reports pointing to escalating Egyptian and Syrian hostilities. Contrary to conventional wisdom that analysts had not properly considered the evidence that war might be approaching, the archives show that the intelligence community received these reports, debated them, and wrote about them. Analysts did consider that the Egyptian and Syrian military maneuvers might be more than just posturing. Analysts did entertain the idea that Egyptian President Anwar Sadat might initiate a conflict that he knew he would lose militarily. But ultimately, the analysts judged that there would be no attack. Or, as the December postmortem put it, the conclusions were, quite simply, obviously, and starkly wrong.
We are no intelligence professionals, obviously, but based on open source information we researched and analyzed, it seems plausible that the postmortem of the October 7 intelligence failure will reveal similar causes that led to this 2023 shocking attack by Hamas. It's important to mention here that Israeli officials said it was far too soon to know what went wrong and rejected any comparison to 1973. It's hard, though, to not go there. Now, this October 7 attack involved dozens of infiltrations by land and sea, together with rocket attacks. So this was a sophisticated month-long assault that requires the kind of planning and coordination that intelligence agencies, ours, our allies, and theirs, the Israelis, are supposed to pick up on. That might be part of the issue, reliance on allies, thinking that if you don't notice something, your partners will. At the same time, your partners might think the same thing, and this might give a false sense of comfort to all parties involved, and the ball is dropped collectively.
That seems plausible, and compounded with everything else we'll discuss, it could make sense.
Yes, and it's essential to understand that the first intelligence failure in this case took place months before the attack, right? But let's look at what internal investigators might do, how they might proceed. How will they go about finding out what exactly happened? Where was the information gap or collection or analysis failure?
As we said, we do not yet and may never know the complete story of this intelligence failure, but we can at least try to put some of the pieces together.
Exactly. I personally believe that the first question investigators will ask is whether Shin Bet, Mossad, and the Israel Defense Force...
Okay, wait. Can you explain for our listeners what Shin Bet is? Not everybody is obsessed with this stuff like you are.
Fair enough. Okay, Shin Bet, also known as Shabak, is the Israeli General Security Service. They are in charge of internal security operations. So they're like our FBI, basically. And Mossad is like our CIA. They operate globally. The Israel Defense Forces, IDF, are the Israeli military. Collectively, Shin Bet, Mossad, and IDF are recognized as some of the very best intelligence/military organizations in the world, second only to ours. So, back to what we were discussing, the first question investigators will ask is whether Shin Bet, Mossad, and the IDF issued warnings of an impending attack, and were these warnings specific and actionable, or were they too general?
One of the most infamous examples of general warning was the president's daily brief written in August 2001 titled, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S." The 9/11 Commission showed that two CIA analysts involved in preparing this briefing article believed it represented an opportunity to communicate their view that the threat of a bin Laden attack in the United States remained both current and serious.
The message that was sent to the White House, right, was not the same message that was received. In other words, what the analysts, you know, thought was a specific enough warning was seen as a way to general warning by leadership. President Bush said the article told him that Al-Qaeda was dangerous, which he had known since he had become president.
And because it was considered too general, the warning did not result in decisive preventative action or improved defenses. More often than not, policymakers expected precise information. An attack by this group will occur within this time frame in this location. But such clear warnings rarely happen, if ever. The Hamas attack on Israel may ultimately prove to be a case of non-specific warning. Some reports indicate that U.S. and Israeli intelligence were watching for rising tensions, but there was no precise warning of an imminent attack.
Yes, the New York Times reported that Israeli intelligence issued a specific warning to border guards immediately before the attack. So the Israeli intelligence did flag a surge in activity and warned the border soldiers. But those warnings, as we said last time, went unheeded for unclear reasons. And this is what the New York Times article said. Shortly before attackers from Gaza poured into Israel at dawn on Saturday, Israeli intelligence detected a surge in activity on some of the Gazan militant networks it monitors. Realizing something unusual was happening, agents sent an alert to the Israeli soldiers guarding the border, according to two senior Israeli security officials.
So, why didn't the soldiers defending the Israeli border act based on these warnings? What exactly happened?
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know what I always say, right? You can't ignore your trauma and hope it disappears. The only way forward is to deal with it. Life keeps throwing curveballs at all of us.
Fireballs, spitballs, too many balls. And when you're overwhelmed, you're not at your best, and it affects your interactions with the people you care about. So how do you deal with it all? Call your therapist like I do. Yes, you be friends, I'm a BetterHelp happy customer, been using their services since way before we even started this podcast.
I can attest to the fact that Sandra is now, let's say, a much lovelier person to be around.
Oh, shut up. Also, my therapist will love hearing that. With BetterHelp, you can tap into a network of over 25,000 licensed and experienced therapists who can help you with a wide range of issues.
If you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, it's affordable, it's flexible, and most importantly, it's entirely online. And you'll get 10% off your first month if you sign up at betterhelp.com/dubious.
Yes, and then you can talk to your therapist whenever and however you feel comfortable, whether it's via text, chat, phone, or video call. If your therapist isn't the right fit for any reason, you can switch to a new therapist at no additional charge. So do yourself a favor, take care of your mental health, because when you feel empowered, you are prepared to take on everything life throws at you.
Visit betterhelp.com/dubious to get 10% off your first month, or click the link in the episode notes.
That's betterhelp, HELP.com/dubious. Well, this is a bit of a mystery. It is possible that the warning wasn't acted upon for three reasons, in my opinion. One, the soldiers didn't get it. Two, the soldiers didn't read it. Or three, the soldiers read it but decided to ignore it, or they didn't have any time left to act at all.
If they read it and ignored it, it could be because, let's face it, Israel has been at war pretty much for 75-ish years. The border soldiers are probably receiving such warnings regularly, and most of the times, nothing happens. Or nothing that the automated systems that the barrier fence was fitted with, the sensors, remote control machine guns, and barbed wire can't take care of. In other words, the soldiers relied on these defenses, assuming that they actually read the warning.
Yeah, or maybe like we suggested earlier, maybe they didn't have time to act, right? If this warning reached them just minutes before the actual attack, it was already too late. Frankly, we'll never know, in my opinion, I don't think we will, we'll never know the specifics. I don't think Israel will make any of this information public. And, or let me put it this way, I don't think they're going to make any of the relevant information public. And I understand why. On one hand, you don't want to lose the trust of your people, which, I mean, I think they, at this point, you know, a little bit of that already happened. But secondly, you don't want to give the enemy insight into how you would normally operate. Any document detailing the intelligence failures would do just that. Once the dust settles, they will put out some reports, you know, like we did after 9/11, like press releases and maybe an official investigation and the results, but it's not going to be anything specific.
And right after that warning was sent, Hamas sent drones to disable some of the Israeli military's cellular communication stations and surveillance towers along the border. This prevented the soldiers on duty from monitoring the area remotely via video feed. The drones also destroyed the remote-controlled machine guns, removing a key component of combating a ground attack.
And this made it easier for Hamas terrorists to approach and use explosives to blow up parts of the border fence. Then they bulldozed the fence in several places, allowing thousands of Hamas fighters to walk through the gaps. These operational failures and weaknesses were among a vast array of intelligence and logistical lapses by the Israeli security services that made the Gazan incursion into southern Israel possible, according to four senior Israeli security officials who spoke with New York Times reporters on the condition of anonymity.
And guess what?
What?
2 weeks before the border breach, Hamas posted a video of a mock attack. They practiced this attack in plain sight.
Yes, when you mentioned that earlier, I wanted to ask more about it. Tell us everything you know, please.
On September 12th, Hamas posted a slickly produced 2-minute propaganda video on social media. It shows fighters using explosives to blast through a replica of the border gate, sweep in on pickup trucks, and then move building by building through a full-scale reconstruction of an Israeli town, firing automatic weapons at human-silhouetted paper targets. They even named this live-fire exercise, dubbing it Operation Strong Pillar. In the video, you can see militants in body armor and combat fatigues carrying out operations that included the destruction of mock-ups of the wall's concrete towers and a communications antenna, just as they would do for real in the deadly attack on October 7th.
Wow. I mean, this makes Mossad and Shin Bet's failure even more catastrophic than we already thought it was. I mean, this Hamas attack on more than 20 Israeli towns and army bases in the October 7 raid was the worst breach of Israel's defenses in 50 years and shattered the nation's sense of security. And for hours, the strongest military in the Middle East was exposed and pretty much rendered powerless to fight back against a much weaker enemy, leaving villages defenseless for most of the day against squads of terrorists who killed more than 1,000 Israelis, including soldiers sleeping in their beds, wearing only their underwear. Hamas abducted at least 150 people, overran at least 4 military camps, and spread out across more than 30 square miles of Israeli territory.
The four Israeli officials the New York Times spoke to say the success of the attack, based on their early assessment, was rooted in a slew of security failures by Israel's intelligence community and military. So what happened, in their opinion? Here are the main points. 1. The intelligence officers failed to monitor certain communication channels used by Palestinian attackers. 2. The military personnel and intelligence officers over-relied on border surveillance equipment that was easily shut down by attackers. 3. The commanders were all in one place, clustered in a single border base that was overrun in the initial phase of the incursion, preventing communication with the rest of the armed forces. And 4. Intelligence officers accepted at face value assertions by Hamas military leaders made on private channels that they were not preparing for battle. Officers were aware that Hamas knew these phone calls were being monitored by Israel.
It's shocking. This is what Yoel Guzansky, a former senior official at Israel's National Security Council, said. We spend billions and billions on gathering intelligence on Hamas. Then, in a second, everything collapsed like dominoes. As we said, the first failure, though, took place months before the attack, and this is the moment in time where all the red flags go up and the dubimeter alarms go off.
Right, this operation took months of planning. The ball was dropped by Israeli intelligence services long before the actual October 7th attack. In the past year, Hamas stayed out of two fights, while the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, a smaller armed group in Gaza, tried to take on Israel alone. In September 2023, Hamas leadership also put an end to the rioting along the border in an agreement brokered by Qatar. This gave the impression that Hamas was not looking for an escalation.
Tzaki Ganebi, Israel's national security advisor, in a radio interview just 6 days before the attack said, "Hamas is very, very restrained and understands the implications of further defiance." When Israeli intelligence officials briefed senior security chiefs in the week preceding the Hamas attack about the most urgent threats to the country's defenses, they highlighted the dangers posed by Lebanese militants along Israel's northern border. The threat posed by Hamas was minimized and barely mentioned. The consensus in the Israeli intelligence community seemed to be that Hamas had been deterred.
Yet, investigators, after looking at whether there were warnings and how precise they were, will examine if the intelligence services had collected information on the potential attack and were holding it in their systems. They will have to scrub databases for signs that Hamas was planning a massive strike, including from established sources and from a multitude of less credible sources like hearsay or walk-ins, etc. Hindsight is always 20/20, and this exercise always poses the risk of unveiling information no analyst would have considered credible at the time, but now seems concrete. If this search exposes information pointing to an imminent attack, the next question is why the relevant information did not prompt a red flag. Right?
Wrong. The next question is, why haven't you reminded everyone about our ad-free episodes yet, Tyler?
Okay, I'll do it now. Dear listeners, you can claim all our episodes ad-free if you become patrons. This is the simplest way you can support Dubious.
Yes, Doobie friends, as you know, because we tell you every single time, we are an independent podcast. We have no team. There are no editors, sound designers, researchers, and so on. It's just Tyler and I, and we do our best every week to come up with interesting content and stories in our free times, on nights and weekends, and even during work hours.
You know what I'm going to say, right?
Don't worry, you won't get fired. We already said it so many times. Everyone knows, including your boss, that you're working on the podcast when you shouldn't.
Well, if I end up jobless, I'll come live in your home and live there rent-free. Oh, so nice. Dear listeners, if you want to support us, please become a patron on dubiouspod.com or by clicking the link in the episode notes right here in the app you're listening to us in.
Okay, so back to the question, why the relevant information did not prompt a red flag, if it existed, right? And frankly, it's hard to imagine no information on this attack was collected. I'm just gonna assume it had to be. And if it was it translated and disseminated to the relevant people? Did analysts read it? If not, why not? If they did read it, why did they dismiss or minimize its importance? There will probably be interviews with analysts, and those discussions will most likely feel quite intrusive and accusatory at times, but you know, this is not gonna be a pleasant thing for anyone to look into the nitty-gritty of how this happened.
If the information was there and analysts missed it or dismissed it, it means this catastrophic failure was brought on by human error. If it turns out the indications were there, but something like holiday leave got in the way, the Israeli intelligence services are likely looking at hours at their desks over holiday weekends in the future. There's also speculation about whether extensive political protests against the prime minister may have also played a role, being a distraction.
Frankly, I find that unlikely because, look, intelligence people, of all people, stay mission-focused, especially when there is domestic turmoil. Maybe even more so then, right, as such circumstances could be exploited by enemies and adversaries. So to me, that's actually, that argument doesn't support that theory. I feel like when there's turmoil, that's when the intelligence community is paying even more attention to what's going on.
Yeah, that's a good point. But if the search for information comes up dry or the results are insignificant enough that no rational analyst could have connected the dots to warn of the massive Hamas attack, then the investigators need to see whether this failure came from a collection gap.
Yes, this is, no matter how you look at it, a massive failure because tens, if not hundreds of Hamas militants were one way or another involved in this assault, which tells us the circle of knowledge was extensive. And moreover, according to the Wall Street Journal, Tehran was involved in the planning and funded the attack, and meetings took place in Beirut, which means the circle of knowledge, I think we mentioned this last time briefly, encompassed at least three locations, Gaza, Tehran, and Beirut. So I don't know, it just seems like such a huge, huge failure that I don't know what word to use for it, but it's I can't wrap my mind around it.
And all intelligence services have plans for multiple ways of collecting information, so multiple routes of entry, right? There's signals intelligence, like phone and internet tapping, imagery intelligence, overhead satellite images, and then human intelligence, human sources for the secrets that cannot be obtained any other way.
Yes, and it's important to emphasize here that the Israeli services have exceptional capabilities for computer network operations, like clandestine entries into adversary phones and computer systems. In fact, their capabilities are so good and so advanced that they have caused quite a scandal in 2022 when Citizen Lab announced that an Israeli firm's hacking tools have been used against journalists, opposition figures, and advocacy organizations across at least 10 countries, including people in North America and Europe.
I think I remember that, yeah. But back to our current subject, for these different types of intelligence, signals, human, and imagery, intelligence collection specialists will develop multiple streams of access, so if one is discovered or shut down, others are still reporting. But it is almost unimaginable how the Mossad, the Shin Bet, and the IDF managed to fail so horribly. It's almost impossible to wrap your head around it.
I agree. That's why the question is, where was the collection on the Hamas operation? I mean, look, it is possible the Israeli services had very few or no human sources, right? After all, Gaza is a closed society and Hamas is in charge of everything there. Anyone spying for Israel would risk both death and potentially the death of their entire family. So it's not a stretch to consider that human sources were either not reporting or worse, had been discovered.
But that leaves signals and imagery intelligence on the table, plus open source collection, right? Like that video Hamas posted in which they breached a replica border wall. So no matter how you turn it, it's still hard to understand how absolutely all of these collection capabilities failed.
Right, but let's look at signals intelligence for a second. The question here is, did Israeli operations to penetrate communications fail to collect information? We must understand that those type of accesses can be fragile, like updating an operating system or patching vulnerabilities can boot spies out of accesses, right? My personal opinion is that Iran must be looked at here closely. We know that Tehran provides rocket technology and financial support to Hamas, so it's not a stretch to imagine they also assist with cyber defense. Same goes for Russia. We talked about Putin's support for Hamas in our last episode. So a possibility here is that as they were preparing for this attack, Hamas, backed by Iran, implemented an extensive cyber cleanup operation.
Not only that, but Hamas employed a classic denial and deception scheme. On a phone line they knew was being monitored by the Israelis, they talked about how they were not thrilled to renew hostilities and how they were still recovering from the conflict in May 2021. This plan worked. As we mentioned earlier in a briefing for senior Israeli security officials last week, briefers assessed that Hamas had been effectively deterred. Israeli intelligence officials said that they are now looking into whether those calls were real or staged. I mean, we all know they were staged, just own it.
Right, and one more thing here. Operational security is paramount, and Hamas knows that. I mean, they're not stupid. Hamas probably kept the planning circle for the attack very tight, and when it needed to expand to include all the players, they most likely compartmentalized the planning. So basically everything was on a need-to-know basis, right? What that means is that the paragliders probably had no idea about the rocket attack, and the amphibious operators were probably unaware of the attack penetrating through the border wall. So only a very small number of people would have had the big picture, would have known the entire plan.
And they were careful enough to discuss this multi-front attack only in person, leaving their phones and any devices outside of the room.
Exactly. Now, back to the Iron Wall we mentioned earlier.
We should probably stop calling it that for obvious reasons. Hamas blew through it like a hot knife through butter.
Fair point. point, fair point. But about the wall situation, the operational failure, I mean, look, the Israeli border surveillance system was almost entirely reliant on sensors, right? And on cameras and machine guns. All of those things were operated remotely. So as we said earlier, the mistake here was that the IDF commanders, the military commanders, were convinced that this system is impregnable. And let's make one thing clear, nothing ever is. Their assessment was that the remote surveillance, the machine guns, the barriers above ground, plus the subterranean wall to block Hamas from digging tunnels into Israel, made such a successful attack almost impossible. And because of this assessment, they reduced the numbers of soldiers physically stationed along the borderline itself.
Yeah, they moved part of the troops to other areas of concern like the West Bank. A retired major general named Israel Ziv, who led ground forces in the south for several years and also served as head of the Israeli Defense Forces Operations Division from 2003 to 2005, said the thinning of the forces seemed reasonable because of the construction of the fence and the aura they created around it, as if it were invincible, that nothing would be able to pass it.
But see, there's a problem with remote controlled systems. You can control them remotely, yes, but they can also be destroyed remotely.
Exactly. And Hamas exploited that weakness by using drones to attack the cellular towers that transmitted signals to and from the surveillance system, rendering that system useless. So the soldiers stationed in control rooms near the front lines did not receive any alarms indicating that the fence separating Gaza and Israel had been breached.
Moreover, they were unable to watch video, right, to pinpoint the locations in which Hamas attackers were bulldozing the barricades. And on top of that, the barrier fence, the fence itself, proved to be much easier to break through than anyone anticipated. And this is how more than 1,500 Hamas fighters managed to surge through nearly 30 points along the border, some of them in paragliders that flew over the top of the barricades. But this is how they managed to break through and reach at least four Israeli military bases without being intercepted.
Photos shared by one of the Israeli officials with the New York Times showed that dozens of Israeli soldiers were shot in their sleep in their barracks. We mentioned that earlier. And the fact that all these troops and the commanders were clustered in only one location was a big mistake. Once this one base was overrun, most of the senior officials were killed, injured, or taken hostage. This, compounded with the communication issues caused by the drone strikes, prevented a coordinated response. No military along the border in those moments was able to grasp the full breadth of the assault.
Brigadier General Dan Goldfuss, an Israeli commander who helped lead the counterattack, said, "Understanding what the picture was of the different terrorists' attack was very difficult. At one point during the attack, the general encountered the commander from another brigade, totally by chance, right? Basically, they ran into each other. And that's how the two men decided ad hoc which villages their respective units would try to retake. This is what he said. We decided just between ourselves, and that's how we went by from one village to another."
All of this meant it was close to impossible, especially in the early stages, to relate the gravity of the situation to the military high command in Tel Aviv. And as a result, no one there understood the urgent need for a massive, rapid air cover, even though social media reports of attacks in many communities started to emerge by then. It took hours for the Israeli Air Force to arrive, even though it has bases just minutes away in flying time.
The October 7 failure has been catastrophic for Israel's security and I think potentially damaging to its reputation in the region as a reliable military partner as well.
Obviously, the Israeli security services do not dispute this massive failure. I mean, how could they?
Right.
But said that a full-on postmortem will be conducted after the war.
Like, I don't know, how unexpected and distressing is this failure by one of the best intelligence communities in the world, you know, to prevent an attack from an adversary that is so much weaker. And also, you know, Hamas is a constant, well-known threat. It shouldn't be something that surprises you.
Books will be written about this, documentaries will be made, podcasts will be recorded. This is one of the biggest intelligence failures in modern history. Could only be compared to what unfolded on 9/11 from an intelligence perspective. The information was there, but it was not assessed right, analyzed properly, and delivered in such a way as to deter the attack. It was a general warning instead of a specific one.
Your analogy reminded me of what Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu said earlier this week about Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah being an axis of evil. Took that one from George Bush's playbook. He said the same thing about Iraq, Iran, and North Korea in his State of the Union address in 2002. And in 2003, we invaded Iraq without a plan of what we're going to do afterwards. And we all know how that went. And now Israel is doing the same thing with this land incursion in Gaza, which is an actual invasion. And this is worrying for many reasons. You can't just go in without proper preparation and clear objectives, and also an actual plan for what comes after. Because look, eradicating Hamas is not a specific actionable plan. It's too general of an objective. And assuming, I mean, obviously they're not going to tell us the exact plans, but judging by our State Department's and our administration's reluctance and their efforts to try to postpone this invasion. I mean, it's telling. We don't think the Israelis have a really good plan in place. And assuming they do eradicate Hamas, by killing so many civilians in the process, they'll make it even easier for extremist groups in the region to radicalize even more Palestinians. So Hamas, in my opinion, can't really be eradicated by this land incursion unless the goal here is something else.
Things are very layered, and there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed before we could form a clear opinion as to what Netanyahu's plans are. You're saying something about how he tried to keep Palestinians divided on purpose when we talked on the phone, but we didn't get a chance to elaborate on that?
Well, we know what he's been trying to do for the past decade. He tried and succeeded in strengthening Hamas.
I'm sorry, what?
Bear with me here. What does Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu and Hamas have in common? A shared hatred for the Palestinian Authority and its leader Mahmoud Abbas. So look, Palestinians have two parties, two political factions, like we have Republicans and Democrats, right? I mean, it's not the best analogy, but, you know, just so that people get an image of what's happening. So they have Hamas, and Hamas controls Gaza, and then there's the Palestinian Authority, who controls and operates from the West Bank, from Ramallah. Right? And the Palestinian Authority is controlled by Fatah, so the former Palestinian Liberation Organization. Anyway, the point is there are two Palestinian political forces, Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, one in Gaza, one in the West Bank of Jordan River.
Why would you say of the Jordan River? We all know where the West Bank is.
I mean, I guess. I mean, you and our listeners, yes, you guys know, but some people don't. Like, I was talking to someone on my dog walking outing the other day, and we got to discussing the conflict in the Middle East, and somehow the person said that it's the bankers ruining everything. And I was like, what bankers? And I shit you not, the guy said, well, the West Bank, for one, all this money Biden gives to these banks. So yeah, I mean, I felt like maybe I should mention, like, it's the West Bank of Jordan. Insane, completely crazy. So please vote, because if we're going to have to live in a Trump world, we are Anyway, back to why Netanyahu, who, by the way, is Israel's version of Trump, obviously smarter, you know, but same extreme right-wing views. So back to Netanyahu, why he supported Hamas. If you have two Palestinian political factions who are at odds with each other, as Hamas and the Palestinian Authority have been since 2007, when Hamas seized total control after winning the elections in 2006, you have a nation, a people who are not unified, right? If Palestinians are not united, there is no danger in Netanyahu's eyes of a two-state solutions, right? Because Palestinians and Israelis each having their own land, that's exactly what Netanyahu doesn't want. Bibi Netanyahu opposed this two-state solution since forever.
This seems like a bit of a stretch to me.
Seems, but it's not. The former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak agrees with me. We'll get there in a minute. But look, Netanyahu, Israel's current Prime Minister, always opposed reconciliation efforts between Hamas and Fatah, the political party backed the Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas, right? And he always opposed the two-state solution. Remember that after the Oslo Accords in 1993, he called the Accords a mortal threat to the State of Israel. We talked about this last time. And the best example is this. In late 2017, the peace efforts to, you know, to bring peace between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority were ongoing, with support from the United States and Egypt. We were doing everything to try to bring peace to the region. And one of the major hurdles in reaching the peace deal was Hamas's assertion that it won't be subordinate to the Palestinian Authority. But However, after long negotiations, Hamas reluctantly agreed to transfer all political powers to the Palestinian Authority in Gaza at the time, while refusing to lay down its arms. During that time, Netanyahu made all possible efforts to derail that deal while claiming that reconciliation between Hamas, and this is a quote, okay, from Netanyahu himself, reconciliation between Hamas and the PLO makes achieving peace harder.
How? You'd assume that by definition, reconciliation between the Palestinians is the first step between a larger goal of reconciliation between Israel and Palestinians, no?
Yes, exactly. But well, Bibi Netanyahu believed that peace between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority would pave the way for a united Palestine, which it would have, essentially leading to a two-state solution, as we said, an idea that Netanyahu opposes vehemently. That's the gist of it. In May 2019, former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak further confirmed this during an interview with Channel 13. And now we're This is an actual quote from the former Egyptian president. Netanyahu isn't interested in a two-state solution. Rather, he wants to separate Gaza from the West Bank, as he told me at the end of 2010. Here are some of Netanyahu's pro-Hamas policies. Under his rule, Netanyahu ensured Hamas got unhindered access to funds flowing in from Qatar and Iran. He did almost nothing to install checks and balances, even when he knew much of this might be directed towards funding terrorists. Much of the money, right, might be directed towards funding terrorists and the flowering of extremist ideology. Without these funds, Hamas would have never developed such a strong military arm, and possibly they would have never carried out the horrific terrorist attack on October 7. In March 2019, Netanyahu himself admitted that he supported the policy of enriching Hamas to keep the Palestinian Authority at bay. Here's what Netanyahu said himself during a meeting with the Likud MKs, the members of Knesset, Israel's House of Representatives. Whoever opposes a Palestinian state must support delivery of funds to Gaza, because maintaining a separation between the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza will prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state. Like, there you have it, right from the horse's mouth. Netanyahu had this clear plan in mind. In order to hurt Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority leader, and prevent the division of the land of Israel into two states, Hamas must be supported. Obviously, not super openly and officially, but by through policies tailored specifically to further these goals.
I mean, now that I think of it, it is a fact that under Netanyahu's rule, Hamas has never faced any major existential military threat from Israeli forces.
See, in fact, according to claims by several Israeli officials and ministers, it is Netanyahu himself who once stopped the IDF's plans to obliterate the Hamas once and for all. So in 2014, IDF launched Operation Protective Edge in Gaza, and this operation had the potential to wipe Hamas off the map once and for all. And they had a very good plan. You know, it was a strategic plan, but Bibi Netanyahu reportedly did something to derail that plan and to shield Hamas.
What did he do?
He allegedly leaked to the media a presentation made by the Israeli military highlighting the potential repercussions and human cost of the operation. The secret document was leaked to peddle this narrative that the operation against Hamas would lead to thousands of casualties for the IDF and it should not be initiated altogether because it would lead to a lot of Israeli military people dying. Of course, the leak was never investigated, but reportedly, Benny Gantz, IDF's former chief of staff, is believed to have said Bibi leaked this. Now, this leaking story is indeed speculative, but given the larger context, I feel like if it fits, it sits.
Are there any other important Israeli officials backing up this idea that Netanyahu did all of these things?
Yes, quite a few of Israel's top military and political leaders have talked about this covert relationship between Hamas and Bibi. In an interview published days before Hamas's October 7 assault against Israel, Avigdor Lieberman, former finance minister, was quoted as saying that Bibi continuously thwarted all the targeted assassinations in Gaza. In August 2019, the former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, said that Netanyahu's strategy was to keep Hamas alive. Quote, his strategy is to keep Hamas alive and kicking, even at the price of abandoning the citizens of the South in order to weaken the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, in the West Bank.
Wow, this can't be dismissed as speculation anymore.
No, I mean, look, it's not a secret. The press talked about this, but it's not breaking news, even though, frankly, it should be. And most people have no idea that Israel, through Bibi Netanyahu, has been backing Hamas for a decade now. And wait, one more important person talked about this as well. Former IDF chief Gadi Eisenkot, in January 2022, claimed that Netanyahu always overruled what the National Security Council suggested, establish two states and engage with the Palestinian Authority. Israel did they did the opposite. It, quote, ostracized the Palestinian Authority and strengthened Hamas, end quote.
I have to admit, it does make sense. This Napoleonic strategy of divide et impera is what Netanyahu has been doing.
Yes, divide and conquer. And now a lot of the Israel's military and all the people who retired from the military, the reservists who are re-enlisting again because of the war, they're understandably upset because Bibi's son, 32-year-old Yair Netanyahu, has been in Florida since April and has failed to show up to support his nation.
In Florida, okay.
I know, let's not even go there because we'll never finish this episode.
Okay, well, what are Netanyahu's people saying in response to the accusations of his support for Hamas?
Frankly, they've been kind of dodging this question lately, and most press is not asking it right now incessantly because everyone is focused on what's happening in Gaza. But from past interviews, their stance is the biggest achievement of the prime minister is separating Gaza from the West Bank, thus virtually killing the idea of a two-state solution. I mean, look, it's insane. They don't even try to sugarcoat it. Jonathan Urich, one of Netanyahu's media advisors, said in April 2019 that Netanyahu basically smashed the vision of the Palestinian state in these two places, referring to Gaza and the West Bank. As I said, it's not a secret. I think there was a press conference sometime last week, and I think Netanyahu kind of like made an excuse saying that he knows there are these accusations floating that he supported Hamas, but he never did. Either way, we have the quotes from the former prime minister, we have the facts, and Netanyahu's policies helped keep Hamas in power and indirectly kept funds filling their coffers. It is what it is. It's a shame that people, innocents on both sides, died and are dying. And it's horrible.
Back to this land incursion that's going on now. Assuming they succeed in destroying Hamas, what's next? What's the plan for what comes after? We said earlier that this is one of the most worrying things.
Yes, there is no actual specific plan. I mean, I'm sure Israel has, you know, like a plan for the military operation, as in logistics and stuff. But there is no plan for after. And with something like this, you can't just improvise as you go along. And this is why our State Department, this is why the Biden administration has tried to postpone this invasion and tried to like push for an actual plan, because we have the experience of what we did before with Iraq, with Afghanistan. We went in without a plan for what happens after we take over, and look how that worked out. So this is truly scary for so many reasons. My main concern is frankly for the civilians in Gaza, and you know, for this conflict to not escalate even further in the region and inflame and devolve into something bigger.
Yeah, I agree. And honestly, I want to talk about how this land invasion will unfold, what it means to fight in a city like Gaza, where the size of the tunnels under the city is almost as big as the surface of the streets above ground. Maybe we'll do this in our next episode.
Right. So, Tyler, what's your dubimeter level for the scale of this intelligence failure by the Israeli intelligence services? 1 to 10.
I'd say it's as high as it goes. 100, but the maximum level is 10, so...
Well, we're on the same page. Dubimeter level 10++++ for Israel's intelligence failure. Dubi friends, if you like us, please recommend Dubius to your friends and family. You know what I always say, personal recommendations are the best recommendations.
We are at Dubius Pod on all social media. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
We love you, Dubi friends, and don't forget, stay dubious.